Welcome back to another episode of the CSK8 podcast. My name is Jared O'Leary. Each week of this podcast is either an interview with a guest or multiple guests or a solo episode where I unpack some scholarship in relation to computer science education. In this week's episode, I'm unpacking a paper titled Examining the Realities and Nuances of Low-Stakes, Interest-Driven Learning Environments. This was written by Marcella Worsley. Here's the abstract for this paper. Quote, the push to develop low-stakes and personally meaningful computer science experiences is creating novel opportunities to broaden participation in CS. These opportunities have become increasingly present across contexts and have expanded the possibilities for introducing and sustaining student participation in computing. However, while these experiences tend to be effective ways for engaging new participants in new forms of participation, we must be careful to not overlook how high stakes these experiences might be for learners. To explore this tension, this paper describes two case studies of students engaging in coding and computational thinking with Minecraft Education Edition. The first case study involves a 7-year-old Black and Latina girl who experiences significant frustration when her computer program destroys significant portions of her project. The second is from a Latino boy who avoids using the coding capabilities in Minecraft EDU out of fear that the code might not work properly. Building on these case studies, this paper suggests that the field takes steps to ensure that the language and actions associated with low stakes and high stakes are reflective of learner perceptions, and that we design learner experiences that appropriately reflect this nuance. End quote. If I were to summarize this paper into a single sentence, I'd say that it discusses two case studies of students programming in low-stakes, interest-driven learning environments. You can find a link to this paper in the description of the app that you're listening to this on, or by simply going to jaredoleary.com and clicking on podcasts. While you're there, you'll notice that this podcast is powered by Boot Up Professional Development, which is the nonprofit that I work for. So check out bootuppd.org if you haven't seen the free curriculum that I create, or if you want to learn more about the professional development that we facilitate. All right, so it's probably no surprise to anybody who's listened to this. I'm a huge fan of interest-driven learning environments. Promote it frequently in my presentations, publications, podcasts, etc. It's a big part of what I did in the K-8 schools that I was working with before I joined Boot Up, and it's something that I highly recommend for a lot of people. But what I appreciate about this paper is it looks at it from a critical lens and says, hey, not all sunshine and roses. There's some things we need to talk about, which I appreciate. So here's a question that kind of guides this short paper. It's from page 45. Quote, in what ways do youth demonstrate the possible high-stakes nature of interest-driven learning in a game-based learning environment? End quote. So in the prior literature section, the author describes frameworks for interest-based learning. They discuss culturally responsive, sustaining computer science. They talk about guidelines and best practices for game-based learning. So if any of those three sound interesting to you, make sure you check out the publications that are cited there. Then the next section on this paper is on the methods. So in the first subsection of this, they talk about program participants and context. So they've been working in this school for a few years now, impacted over 1,000 students and 15 educators. But this particular paper is just going to talk about two students, Amelia and Alejandro. And the author obviously points out that, like, look, this is just two perspectives on here. This is not the norm, but it's something we need to consider. They mentioned that they've noticed similar interactions or responses with other students, and I have as well. Even though I recommend interest-driven learning environments, because it works great for like 95% of the students I've worked with, there's still the 5% we got to talk about and consider, or maybe even provide an alternative for those particular students. Next subsection under methods talks about the background on Minecraft Education Edition. So if you're not familiar with it, it's an education version of Minecraft. You're able to do some different like extensions basically where you can like program stuff in the game and it'll like run code that you write to like build stuff or destroy things or whatever. So there's a lot of really interesting things you can do. So check that out if you haven't seen it before. You can just like search on YouTube for examples of it and people will give you some overviews. All right, so the case studies, this is the main bulk of the paper. So the first one is Amelia. So Amelia signed up to attend a once a week program that was for 6 weeks long during a winter term. And Amelia is described as, quote, a gregarious 7-year-old Black and Latina girl who attends a Title I school in the Midwest region of the United States of America, end quote, from page 46. Now, Amelia's 6-week program was actually disrupted with COVID. So the author describes an incident that actually occurs during the summer of 2020 during a 4-week section that was kind of like a makeup for the winter session. So during this time, the students who participated were engaging in like collaboratively creating a treehouse amusement park. So Minecraft, if you haven't played it, you can have friends join into the same server. And that makes it so that you can play in the same world and like build stuff together or go on adventures or whatever, which is what my wife and I did and how I was able to propose to her through a mod that I made for the game, which if you haven't seen that video, I'll link to it in the show notes. Okay, so while they were doing this like amusement park creation, the researchers would show students like different things that they could do with code in Minecraft, like how to build a house or stairs or whatever. Now, in one of the incidents that Amelia ran into, she was trying to do something with a program which would make it so that it would allow you to dig to excavate an area. So to like clear out, I don't know, like a hill or a mountain, something that's in the way to make it like flat or something like that. While she was running the code to dig, it ended up destroying much more than she had intended, and so she became visibly upset because it, like, destroyed some stuff that she had built or had been working on. When she ran it, it actually ended up continuing to run longer than she intended to. So she started the code and then was unable to make it stop. And so it destroyed the structure that she was trying to, like, add onto. And as she continued through this process, it just kept, like, she'd reload it, come back, and it'd end up destroying things. So she got pretty upset and then refused to actually try building the structure again. So she had what might be described as, like, a fixed mindset in that she felt like she could not properly use the code to do what she wanted to, and then convinced herself that the best way to do it was just to manually excavate or dig in the ground rather than running the code for automatically digging. But even though she may have felt that manual was, like, the safer way to do it, she felt that it was a poor use of her time because of what she knew what she could do with the code builders, so she ended up actually not engaging with Minecraft for several months. And it was roughly a year later that she actually started Minecraft again. And while she might use some of the commands to, like, teleport to different locations or change the time of day, she did not use the code builder to excavate for her, dig for her, or build stuff. And so the author in this particular section cites G's work, which I've talked about quite extensively on this podcast. Like, check out the podcast on Affinity Spaces, or check out the interview with Brian Brown, which I'll link to in the show notes. Both kind of talk about G's understandings of, like, Affinity Spaces or situated language and learning, which are two really important concepts, in my opinion, that educators should check out. Heavily influenced the way that I facilitated classes. So here's a quote from page 47 that kind of summarizes things. Quote, "She made multiple attempts to utilize the code builder, but to no avail. Instead of being an experience where she could leverage computer science to improve her Minecraft world, she became detached from both coding and Minecraft." End quote. A little bit further down on that page, quote, "In this case, the code builder was actively detracting from Amelia's goals of creating her structure. The ongoing challenges reinforced that she was not effectively learning how to use the code builder, and this was negatively impacting her self-perception," end quote. All right, so that was kind of a summary of the first case, but let's talk about the second one, Alejandro. Here's a quote from page 47. Quote, "Alejandro is a seventh grade Latino boy. He enjoys playing console video games and computer games, but does not really identify as a gamer. While happy to talk, Alejandro tends to keep to himself. In class, he sat at a computer where there was no one to his left and typically an open seat to his right. This relative aloneness did not seem to bother him," end quote. I can relate to that. Honestly preferred it. So in this particular case, the author describes how Alejandro wanted to build stairs using, again, code builder. Here's a quote from page 47. Quote, "Alejandro was impressed with himself when we got it to work and showed his peers that he had successfully coded a large staircase. I congratulated Alejandro on his persistence and went to work with some of the other students in the class. However, when I passed by Alejandro a few minutes later, he was manually constructing the other side of the arena. When I asked him about why he decided not to use the code, he remarked that it was too risky. In short, while he was able to eventually figure out how to make the stairs, the various roadblocks and challenges that we had to overcome instilled a general sense of distrust in the code. Moreover, he was concerned that if he tried to use the code, something might go wrong, and portions of his arena would need to be reconstructed," end quote. So having built stuff in Minecraft before, I can totally understand this. Not everything you make is going to be, like, perfectly symmetrical. And so if you run code, like, on one side of an area, it might not work in another. So sometimes, if it's going to be asymmetrical or unique in terms of the overall design, not just cut and paste, then running the code might take longer. Or maybe you just need to start, like, smaller chunks of code, rather than, like, building the whole staircase just, like, one floor or one level or something. All right, so the next section on this paper talks about the discussion. So the author mentions that a lot of these challenges or frustrations could have been prevented if students had the ability to undo, like, a control Z, or if you had, like, a transparent overlay that would show you, here's what it's going to look like if you run this code. So it gives you at least a preview of what's going to happen. So it doesn't, oh, I should have moved over by one and not, you know, deleted my entire building. But here's a quote from page 48 that's important. Quote, "It is important for adults to be sufficiently trained with a collection of strategies to address both the content and the emotional nature of potential moments of youth distress," end quote. Definitely agree with that. Had many guests on talk about social and emotional learning, so check out the podcast to talk about that in the show notes. But also just in general, like, I remember a kindergartner who would come into the computer lab for the first couple months of school, and he would cry about wanting his mom. One of the strategies that I would do to help redirect his attention away from wishing that he was home was to ask questions like, "What'd you have for lunch today?" Or, "What's something funny that happened on recess?" Or just, like, other questions that would help with that emotional regulation to kind of distract him temporarily, and help them reset. When it comes to frustration with like schoolwork or whatever, it's very helpful to have some kind of a strategy like that to help manage that frustration or work through it. So working through problem solving or emotional regulation or whatever, many different approaches or strategies can be used, but I definitely agree with his statement. All right, so here's a main point that's a paragraph in page 48 that I'd like to read. Quote, "While we have primarily talked about the work in the context of Minecraft, the ideas raised also have relevance across interest-based learning environments more broadly. Technological or design choices of the coding platform should include some intentional features that recognize the high level of importance that youth might place on the program content within interest-based and/or culturally sustaining computing experiences. Similarly, instructors and facilitators should help normalize making mistakes as a common part of the programming process, and teach students strategies for proactively managing those errors. Finally, educators should be taught core practices for supporting participant social-emotional well-being. While this is being increasingly emphasized within in-school K-12 contexts, social-emotional learning should be equally as integral to educator learning and support in out-of-school contexts. Far from being spaces where youth become relaxed and indifferent, these interest-driven spaces may be closely tied to youth identities, aspirations, and community roles. As a result, there can be a high propensity for emotionally charged interaction. Failure to attend to these considerations could result in the cycle of goals, identity, and learning negatively impacting one another, and pushing youth further away from computing-related experiences." End quote. That's an excellent set of points to consider. If you are going to encourage people to create projects that are of interest to them, how might you support and respond to students who are interested in exploring projects that might be considered controversial or emotionally charged? So for example, would you encourage students to explore a topic related to politics that's relevant? What about related to a family member dying? What about related to social justice issues and human rights? Depending on where you're teaching, you might have different laws in place for that may prevent students or you from actually addressing any of those things that might want to come up. So it's something that you'll need to consider. But also, if students are exploring it, it might cause other students to react positively or negatively, or just emotionally in some kind of a way. And so we need to have support for that. So it's a very important thing to consider when engaging in interest-driven learning. Most of the projects that kids created were just kind of fun or for the lulz or whatever, but sometimes kids would explore a heavy topic or an emotionally charged one. And that's okay, as long as you're able to support them in some way. And if not, speak with a counselor. Try and get some input on how you can best support students. Which leads to another lingering question or thought that I have after reading this paper is, when is interest-driven learning challenging or taxing on students? Just because it's fun doesn't mean it's not difficult. Like if you listen to the interview with Bob Irving, the second one, where he talks about his book, Hard Fun, it'd be a lot of fun engaging in programming and exploring your interests, but it doesn't make it easy. And it doesn't mean it's not like emotionally or intellectually taxing. So how can we support them? What kind of support can we provide in moments like those? Far too often, when people talk about interest-driven learning, and when I say people, I do include myself on this, we talk about the positives, all the like great things that you can do with this approach. But we also need to talk about how it can be overwhelming for some if they're not used to this approach. We need to provide some scaffolding to help them. So I really appreciate that this author talks about some things that we should probably discuss more if we're using interest-driven learning in our classes. But anyways, this was a short paper, so a short podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. I hope you consider reading it, checking out the author's other works. If you enjoyed this, please consider sharing with somebody else or sharing a review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. Stay tuned next week for another episode. And until then, I hope you're all staying safe and are having a wonderful week.